Hi everyone, it's Kevin G, the best thing since space, and you're listening to Therapy Suite right here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio. This week, I talked to chartered psychologists Jess Baker and Rod Vinson about super helper syndrome. Jess, Rod, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hi, Gavin. Thank you. I'm really well. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. It's been a busy week. I work in local authority. Hi there. I work in local authority, so I'm always very busy. How's your week been? I know we were, just to all the listeners, we were talking about Shropshire and how jealous I am that the fact that both these guys live in Shropshire and it's meant to be beautiful, and I've never been there before, but I have to go there.
You do. You have to come and visit. You bring your waterproofs.
And... How's the week been for both of yourselves?
Sorry?
How's the week been for both yourselves?
Very good, yeah. Very good,
thank you.
Nothing major going on. We're doing writing lots of articles about the book at the moment. So we've been very busy churning out things for magazines and websites and lots of PR.
Brilliant. We'll be talking about the book as well anyway. Look, Jess, Rod, tell us a bit more about your backgrounds and how you both got to where you are today.
Okay, well, my career has been as a chartered psychologist, as a business psychologist. So basically going all over the world, working with leaders in businesses, and I've worked, I think, in 41 different countries, coaching people, running leadership development programs. So that's what I've done with a lot of my life. But I'm also a writer, so I've written a lot of poems and stories and a couple of novels and things, been on many writing courses. And most recently, I've stopped all of my sort of psychology work. And I've teamed up with a young Irish guy who took some of my poems and put them to music. And we kind of really, I didn't expect them to be lyrics for songs, but they turned out to be. And then he said you could play the bass, which I didn't expect to do either. So I learned to play bass. So we've been recording and releasing songs as O'Reilly and Vincent. And that's been fantastic. So I've been very, really wrapped up in the music as well. Unfortunately, he's in Ireland, as I think you know. So he's not available all the time. He's at Trinity College, and we haven't been able to do as much gigging as we did start gigging just before lockdown, in fact,
and it's
going really well. But at the moment, it's a bit quieter. But we're still recording and releasing material.
Fantastic! That sounds brilliant. Okay.
Yeah. It is. It's a miracle the way the music. I was away for a few days and I came back home. And obviously, I know Finn really well. And he'd come to visit and catching up with him. And then they were like, Jess, you have to listen to this. And Finn, we've got a guitar here at home anyway. And Finn was just strumming away really beautifully. And he has the most beautiful voice. And I recognized some of the lyrics that were, Rod's kind of dying poems, really, to say it. It's a bit sad, but Finn had breathed new life into them, and together they just sounded amazing. It was just a small miracle, really. And you've got two albums now.
Yeah.
Gosh, busy. That's
and
busy.
I love playing bass guitar. That's been an incredible joy. Do you play an instrument?
I don't. Years ago, I was learning. The school days. I remember we were learning to play the ukulele. Then later on in high school, the keyboard and all that kind of thing. But unfortunately, it's not something I carried on. I always wanted to play the guitar. I always wanted to kind of learn the electric guitar, but it's not something. Yes, because it looked
play
really
bass.
Cool as well.
Learn bass.
Bass.
Spend your life. I tell you, to go to, and it's just amazing. It's a fantastic.
I'm glad you're passionate about it. I'm glad you do something that you're really passionate about, because you have to play an instrument which is, it's the instrument that that drives you the most, isn't it? Mm.
I didn't expect to have an affinity for it, but I just love it. And the wonderful thing as well with bass is that there's all these sort of backing tracks you can play along with. So you can have, an incredible band, playing along with you, with no bass.
Online.
And and you're just putting in the, improvising bass lines. And it's fantastic.
Must be. Exactly. It does sound fantastic. Absolutely. Basically, tell us about super helper syndrome. I mean, what exactly is it? Where do I start? Where do you start?
Where do I start? So the super helper syndrome is a state that you can get to when you find yourself having helped a lot, either for some people in lots of different ways, lots of different aspects of their life. So they might help as part of their job, they might volunteer, they might be supporting family, young or older adults. They might help their friends and neighbours, as most of us do, or their colleagues. But that's also coupled with a sense of not looking after your own needs as well, Gavin. You know, the not looking after yourself as well as you're looking after all these other people. So the super helper syndrome itself, we've nailed it down to four common adverse impacts. And through the research that we've done, so not only do we come with years of experience as psychologists, but also we did some research for the book. We interviewed 50 people. And looking at the data and what we know is so common is the kind of four adverse impacts, which are exhaustion. You know, I don't need to say much more about that. I think we all know what it looks and feels like sometimes. But then there's also resentment. So when you're giving in so much of yourself, you can sometimes feel resentful that because you're not asking for anything in return either. You're like, no, I'm fine. Oh, no, it's nothing, you know, and you're giving and helping and doing all these things for the people. So no one, because you're not asking for anything in return, nobody's giving you anything in return, which in some ways causes an imbalance in that relationship, which then can cause you to feel a bit resentful. And nobody likes feeling that, but that is something that we've come across time again. The third adverse impact is really where you feel
exploited.
Sorry, I'm just like, so the third adverse impact is where you feel exploited. And there's a sense that people are taking too much from you. They're asking too much from you. And because you're glad to give, you want to. And we spoke to people. I remember interviewing one particular woman who had given so much to her team and her colleagues. She'd worked an extra 69 days. You know,
69 days.
She's actually an accountant, so she worked out. She's actually sitting there calculating the day before our interview. I worked it out, and I think we were only in September at that point in the year as well. She'd already worked an additional 69 days. So organization, you know, exploitation can happen in a number of different ways to people who want to help. And then the fourth adverse impact is self-criticism, which unfortunately works at two levels. So it's at the everyday level, as we describe it, it's about not feeling enough, like I didn't help that person, or I could have done more, or I should have done more, or that person didn't tell me they were in need, and I should have known, I should have been able to tell, you know. But there's also the other level of self-criticism, which is added, like kind of, it's layered on like heavy cement. This is the self-criticism of, I shouldn't feel the other adverse impacts. I shouldn't feel exhausted. I should be super powered and carrying on through. I shouldn't feel resentful. I don't want to feel like a resentful person. I'm compassionate. I see myself as a good person. I don't want to be exploited. How can I be so stupid to be exploited by this person? Or I should be able to stand up for myself and not be taken for granted. So you can see how those adverse impacts and the super helper syndrome kind of can play out in so many different ways.
Is it something to do with DNA super helper syndrome at all?
So being a helper, there is some evidence that empathy has a hereditary component. So definitely, you know, they've even identified the specific genes that you know that are involved. So you know, there's definitely scientific evidence to suggest that some people have more empathy than others. And that would suggest that they'd be perhaps more likely to want to help more. So we think, yeah, there can be a genetic component. But what we did was we identified a number of beliefs that hold. So why people become vulnerable to the super helper syndrome is that they typically hold certain beliefs. And most commonly, those come out of your childhood and how you were brought up and your experiences. So it's probably like everything in life. You know, most things are a combination of genes and environment. You know, are sort of partly about you know, your hereditary characteristics and partly about your experiences. And I think it's probably the same with this.
So some people have it and some people don't. We all have, but to a certain degree, some people more than others.
Have what, empathy or
no, the super helper syndrome.
Oh, I see. I wouldn't say that. I'd say that there are definitely lots of people who don't help very much.
That's what I'm trying to figure out. Yeah, that's what I'm, yeah.
Do you know anybody you would say who spends all their life helping other people?
Yeah. From working in local authority, you meet many people in different organizations. Age UK, for example, I've met a good few people who they go, and in social services as well, in local authority, there's people that you can tell go above and beyond. Mm-hmm. Everyone works as much as they can and works as hard as they can. Yeah. But you know, there's always certain people that will just put that bit extra more in, if that makes sense. Yeah. And when I heard, and I didn't know about super helper syndrome until I came across both yourselves, basically. And at that point, I was thinking, I started reflecting, thinking about it. And I thought, oh, do you know what? I wonder if you start reflecting and thinking about people that you've bumped into in the past, or, you know, on a professional level or personal as well. And you think, oh, because you're right. I mean, some people have different levels of empathy, and not everybody has that same level. And so I started thinking, oh, you know, I'm sure that person must have had it, or that person. But you can kind of tell, can't you? I'm sure you've both spoken to people that have the syndrome. So, you know,
it's so interesting, because to us, it does, like I said, it reveals itself in different ways with different people. So it could be that you're helping in lots of different aspects of your life. It could be that you're helping at work as part of your job. It could be that you are a carer working full time as a carer, paid or unpaid. So you might just be working with one person, perhaps. But what's been really interesting for both of us is that ever since we started writing the book a couple of years ago, we've been talking to people coming in and out of the house, or people in the street, people in our community. And so many people will say, that's me, that is. You know, one guy came to do a bit of painting for us, and he's like, oh, that's me. I'm always being asked to fix stuff for people, to do things for people, to running around everyone. So it kind of reveals itself like as the fixer in the family, or the problem solver, or the mediator. Remember a guy on Twitter tweeted saying, that's me, that is, and it's exhausting. So it's not for anyone, it's not for us to say if anybody does, it's for people to self-identify in that way, because it's so vast and varied. It's not a particular psychological profile.
No.
It's a state that you can find yourself in when you give so much, when you help so much, and you're not looking after your own needs.
So it's very, so the super helper syndrome is very kind of clearly defined as when you're helping compulsively and not looking after your own needs. So it's a combination of those behaviours rather than a sort of personality type or a trait. And, you know, that was important to us. I mean, although, you know, people are always asking us, people say I'm a super helper now because they've seen the book, or they've seen, you know, and there've been lots of articles that we've been asked to write that where people say, what is a super helper? Or, you know, why is it bad to be a super helper if you're a therapist, or all this? And we've ended up using the expression super helper, which we never wanted to. We've been sort of dragged into that. You know, we very deliberately and carefully, because we're professional psychologists, didn't want a label. And it's fine. Obviously, if people want to take a label for themselves, that's fine. But I don't want to label anyone else, you know, say you're a super helper or you're not a super helper. But what we've said is there is a thing, the super helper syndrome, which is if you're helping compulsively, but you're not looking after your own needs, then that combination of behaviors is super helper syndrome. Is that a bit clearer about?
Yeah, no, it is, absolutely. You know, it's kind of what it is in the name. The way it's been named, isn't it? Super helper syndrome. It's like, because you're always going to find people which are more helpful than others. And that's not a criticism. That's just part of the way people are. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's within yourself, isn't it? It's more to do with, you know, that I kind of get the DNA thing that you mentioned as well. It's kind of within all of us, how much, to what degree we all help, you know?
And absolutely, Gavin. And I think, you know, there are loads of people who help a lot, and at the same time they're really good at having boundaries, they're really good at looking after themselves, got to an age or a stage in their career where they're like, actually now I need to start saying no more, and they are looking after themselves, in which case they once perhaps were susceptible to super helper syndrome, but now they're not, you know. And of course, if they continue to want to refer to themselves as super helpers, that is absolutely up to them. And it can be a lovely state to be in, and we talk in the book about how helping can be really good for you. Actually, you can benefit personally from helping others as well. So it's not all bad. We're not all down on helping. We just wanted to highlight something that I'd seen. So earlier you asked about Rod's background, and If I may just jump in and say how I've seen from my experience for the last 20 or so years of working in psychology. So I've worked in the NHS, I've worked with older adults in psychiatric units, eating disorders, personality disorders, and worked in nursing homes as well. And one of the things I have always witnessed in any one of those groups or teams of colleagues, and across the NHS and social healthcare trusts and things, but there's always somebody going above and beyond, as you said as well, that you've noticed in local authority. You know, there's always somebody going, well, normally more than one person, you know, giving as much as they possibly can and almost compulsively, almost feeling like they ought to. And it was in that, I think, that certainly struck us. And in the last couple of years, I've had lots of private coaching clients, and they have seemed, there seemed to be a theme and a thread. And I would say to Rod, oh my goodness, you know, without obviously breaking any confidentiality, I'd say, yeah, there's definitely a theme here. Quite a lot of these people are feeling like they've lost their own sense of self or identity. They're looking after young children and bringing up families, as well as looking after their older parents. They're what some people refer to as sandwich carers. So they're helping in lots of different directions. They're also lovely. They're empathic. They identify as helping at work and going above and beyond. But at the same time, they've lost their sense of self. And I think it was through some of those themes that there was some very strong commonalities between some of the experience I've had before, some of the private coaching clients I've had, and some of my own experience and some of Rod's experience as well, and kind of drawing that all together to say there's something here that hasn't ever been talked about in this way, which is partly why it was so important for us to try and conceptualize this thing that no one's ever talked about or coined.
Of course, of course. We're just going to go to a quick ad break and we'll continue after that. Okay.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
So thanks for that, Jess. That was brilliant. You know, what you explaining a bit about, you know, your involvement as well and what you've seen day to day professionally as well, in terms of super helper syndrome and, you know, identifying those people in the community. And I know we've covered a bit about some of the negatives, because it sounds like to me, and I've seen it, I can see in reflection, I've seen people which are, and I'm sure they were, you know, and super helper syndrome, people that do that, go that extra mile to help people, but then they can get worn out. They can, and I hear that about resentfulment. People can become, they give so much of themselves away, and in the end, they feel so worn out and down by that. And, you know, we're all human, and they all have emotions, and people try and help people as much as they can, but there has to be boundaries. You've got to be careful, because people can burn out and worn out and lose identity, like you mentioned before, you know, and that kind of thing. So there's definitely some negatives there as well. While I know there's massive positives about, you know, helping people on a really great level and helping as much as you can, boundaries, it sounds like almost through development, people have had to learn to basically learn to, you know, grow those boundaries and say, actually, hold on a second. Am I taking on too much now? Am I doing too much? And that's, I'm wearing down because of that, you know? Mm. Basically, what are the key things to think about when you're trying to help someone? And I suppose that would mean considering boundaries for that person that's trying to help, if that makes sense.
Mm. So when you think about the question of what are the key things to think about when you're trying to help someone, you can look at that sort of from the point of view of the helper and the helpee, because of course for helping to work, you know, it has to be satisfactory, for it has to work from both sides. And, you know, the helpee has to be helped, you know, I mean, whatever it is they need help with needs to be sorted out in some way, but hopefully not at the, you know, to the cost of the well-being of the helper. So we actually cover both sides of that in the book, and we look at when helping works and when it doesn't. So we can, you know, talk a bit about that, and the, you know, fact that so if you think about the question of what are the key things to think about when you're trying to help somebody from the point of view of the helpee, then one of the most important, the most important thing you could say is to find out what they really want, what they really need. So the biggest mistake people make when trying to help is assuming that they know what the other person needs or wants. And the answer to that is, hey, ask questions. You know, so question, you know, so if I'm trying to help you, then what I should do is ask you, what do you need? And but people just don't do that as much as they, you know, it might seem obvious when I say
give
it now.
Advice, don't we?
Yeah, we launch in with advice and we answer in solutions. Exactly that, and we give several examples of that where maybe they didn't want advice, maybe all they wanted was a hug, you know. So there are different types of help, and we talk about four forms of help, so one of them is supportive help, and another is information help. And if you're giving advice, that's information help. Well, that's great. If you're a teacher, people want information help, you know, to tell me how to do calculus or something like that in mathematics. But if you know, if I'm falling apart, maybe what I need is supportive help, with somebody to say, you know, to give me some sympathy and to maybe give me a hug or
those listening. Sort of things. Yeah.
So we look a lot of, so that's kind of one half of the equation of what you're asking about. But then of course we're also very interested in making helping work from the point of view of the helper. And that's where the things you're talking about, like boundaries, come in. Where sort of not helping compulsively, not helping beyond your limits of your capacity to do so, not helping beyond the limits of your responsibility to do so, and all of those sorts of things. So you don't get end up in exhaustion, resentment, self-criticism, and exploitation that we talked about earlier. So.
100%.
Yeah, so I could go on about that.
No, that's all right. That's okay.
There's lots more to say about the whole psychology of when helping works and when it doesn't. Yeah,
it's almost like, someone needs that external person. This is where, for example, in a professional environment, it's be like maybe supervision from management or whoever it might be, saying to the person, you know what, are you taking on too much? And now look, let's be honest, right? In work, people want people to get people to do things as much as they can. I know, and we all know that. I'm sure we've all been in that kind of corporate structure where, you know, people want to get the most out of their employees in terms of productivity. But it's almost like you also need a good manager to say, well, hold on a second. Are you taking on too much? Is there too much, you know, and absolutely, kind of trying to equal out the work between everybody as well.
Wouldn't it be great if more managers did that and were was sort of responsible in that way? But again, we give one example in the book from a management consultancy that one of us knows very well, where there was one particular senior manager there. And that person was famous for the fact that nobody ever got promoted out of that department, because if they were good, that manager wanted to keep them and wanted to, you know, sort of wring as
that's
much awful,
work out
isn't
of them
it?
As
possible. Yeah.
That is like, and it's quite ruthless out there. I mean, that's why a lot of people like to try and come out of the corporate structure. But again,
yeah,
not
but
everybody.
Think,
sorry, go on, Jess.
I'm
sorry,
it happens in healthcare too.
You're in the local authority. I'm sure there are a very small group of people really doing the majority of the work. You know, I'm sure that everyone is, of course, trying their best, trying their hardest, but there tends to be a small number of people, you know, the 80-20 rule, 20, you know, percent of the people actually carrying that team or are so dedicated. And the worst thing is, we've all seen it, where if you're the one working hard, you're conscientious, you always say yes to taking on new challenges or responsibility or projects or tasks, then you're the person that your manager is going to go to say, hey, I've got this other thing, why don't you do it? Because they know you're going to say yes, they know you want to help, they know you have a compulsion and a desire to do your very best and your utmost. And so again, you know, there's this downside, unfortunately, to you as the helper, although all you're trying to do is a really good job, you know, all you're trying to do is the best you can, and yet somebody finds that too easy to exploit you. So wouldn't it be lovely if, like, we talk about the compassionate leadership, don't we, as well, and there is a call for managers, and I have come across lots of them, and I'm sure you have too, Rod, you know, where some of my coaching clients will say, you know, they're HR directors. How do I get the managers to not continue to put on those few people, but actually try to spread the workload? And it's certainly a challenge for lots of people business.
And unfortunately, exploitation was one of the four adverse impacts of the super helper syndrome that we identified from our interviews as well and the questionnaires we did. You know, so that's why, and sad.
Of course. And I think it's all industries. I think management will always, they always do try and get the most out of their employees. But at the same time, if there's someone that's good and they always take on work, I think management tends to home in on that. And that's one of their skills. They know who, I think in management, they know who to give certain pieces of work to and, you know, kind of getting the most out of their teams. But at the same time, if someone's becoming worn out by, you know, getting the kind of, maybe they're always getting complex projects or cases or whatever it might be, there might be a toll more so on that person. Because at the end of the day, I know there's different resilient levels, but there's so much as a human being, you know, you can take on. You know, I've spoken to people, I've read articles of people where they worked X amount of hours per week and they ended up kind of burning out, you know, doing all these extra hours. And Jess, you said something really interesting early on. You lose your identity. People lose who they are as a person because you become part of that kind of, that corporate person, you know, and you lose some of your, I've spoken to people where they've left companies due to morals and ethics, not aligning to their own values. I remember once years ago in local authority, someone had to, because of the financial crisis, they had to unfortunately lay off people and they were having a real difficult time dealing with that. You know, because they didn't agree with it. But at the same time, there was no choice. It's funding, you know, and cutbacks and all the rest of it. So, yeah, it's the corporate world has its pros and cons. I mean, obviously, there's pros as well, you know.
And I think we're seeing it now what with the question here in the UK about whether, you know, the nurses are being balloted to strike or not. And that's perfect case, perfect example of where, you know, people may be feeling exploited. People may have, you know, joined the healthcare service to be able to help as much as possible. But unfortunately, it's a system that does require a lot from you. It does ask a lot from you. And unless you can feel like you can assert yourself and protect your own boundaries, and unless you know your own limits and you are willing to voice those, it's going to be very difficult for you to find, you know, that anyone else does respect your boundaries too.
There's a quote in the book that we used from one of the interviews that I remember, that one of the nurses said, just because somebody takes a job in the caring professions doesn't mean they give up all their human rights. But sometimes they are kind of expected to, it's expected that you will work beyond your capacity to do so, because what you're doing is valuable and you know, important and saving lives.
Of course, 100%, 100%. We're just going to another quick ad break and we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
So just come back to the point of the nurses. I've always thought that the healthcare staff should always have had an increase years ago. I just don't think people are paid enough, you know. And I can understand people not being obviously very happy about, you know, safety issues as well as pay and that kind of thing. You know, and I think a lot of people go into nursing and other industries to try and help, and they might find that they're not being supported well, unfortunately. Not everyone, but some people not being supported, you know, as well as they could be, you know.
But yeah, there's an interesting theme that came up, and I only came upon it when I did an interview. I did interview several nurses in different areas of nursing, and one of them mentioned the term moral distress. And I hadn't heard of that before. And she kindly then referred me on to somebody else. And I spoke to this person about moral distress, Professor Alison Leary, and she's into workforce modelling for the NHS. So she comes from an engineering mathematical background, now applying that to the NHS workforce. And ultimately, I mean, we have several examples of it in the book where you are so, I would say the word desperate to care, to give quality, high quality care, you know, to any one of these patients that you have responsibility for. But at the same time, the resources do not allow you within that scenario, that situation, whether it's the number of patients in a ward, you know, has increased, whether it's the fact that there's a member of staff or two off sick, or, you know, whatever those resources might look like. There's a really lovely example of, one nurse said she's an allocated nurse for six patients suffering from acute delirium or dementia. They've been placed in one bay because of staff shortages. And she said in the interview, I didn't have anyone who was able to help with lunches. Three of the patients were too frail to feed themselves, and I needed to go and prepare IV antibiotics for almost all of them. And she's carried on, and she said, I had to choose to give people medication rather than sitting and giving them a meal. She says, you feel awful. You feel really guilty because you're not giving people the care that they fundamentally need.
That is awful, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just heart-wrenching, isn't it, hearing stories like that you know are happening every day. So, you know, I mean, I suppose one question always comes to my mind is like, what could you tell a nurse who feels like her hands are tied like that? You know, is there any solution for her? And I would have to say, well, my job as a coach and as a psychologist is, you know, my role is limited here. But what I would urge anybody in that situation, in whatever helping scenario they're in, we've spoken to carers who are unpaid carers, perhaps, you know, for looking after elderly or infirm relatives. And they do feel like their hands are tied. You know, they do feel like there's nothing else that they can do. They just have to carry on. But I think that speaks to one or two of the irrational beliefs we've called out in the book. And it sounds really harsh, but you do have to find a way to look after yourself. And we actually take the reader through a whole process of identifying their helping behaviours and their helping habits. And we take them through to the later parts in the book to help them explore their own choices, because ultimately there are choices to be had here. That sometimes when you're stuck in a relationship where you are compulsively helping, whether that's a situation at work or with somebody you know and love, actually you do have choices.
Tell us a bit more about your book. I think it'd be brilliant to hear more about the book, what it's called, what it's about, and where people can find it, you know?
The book is called The Super Helper Syndrome, A Survival Guide for Compassionate People. And it was published a few weeks ago.
Congratulations. That's fantastic.
Thank you very much.
That is fantastic.
Kevin, lovely to talk about it. So thank you very much for asking.
No, please. I want to hear about it.
Yeah. And so a lot of the things that we've been talking about are obviously in it. And then there's a whole, and because, you know, obviously we focus quite a lot in talking to you about, you know, it's been quite a lot of doom and gloom. And I feel that, you know, a lot of the book, you know, the book is in three parts, and, you know, the third part is called The Healthy Helper. So, you know, and so, you know, a whole big section of the book is about all of the positive things you can do to look after yourself when you're looking after other people. And you know, we've mentioned about setting boundaries, but we talk about lots of other forms of ways you can care for yourself, whether that's mindful self-compassion and things like that, learning assertiveness as well. A big part of it is about understanding your own thinking and understanding why you help compulsively, because if you're in a really demanding job, for example, where you're helping people all the time, you know, whether it's as a social worker, we've mentioned nurses a lot, but it might be a therapist, it might be a teacher, all sorts of different professions. If you're giving a lot, then you know you probably should be limiting the amount of giving and helping you're doing in your personal life as well. you know, it would be okay for you not to be the person who's looking after all your friends and family too, if you're in that situation. So it's about sort of being more realistic. So there's lots of positive stuff about what you can do. There's also a lot of the story of Jess Baker's life in there as well. As well, if you don't mind me. Well, it's in here. So
no, please do.
It's in the
book.
So no, I'm not asking Jess, not you. Okay, so the story behind, there's a story behind this. So before I hand over to Jess, and she can sort of tell
me. No, I don't want to talk about myself in that way.
There you go. I'll talk about Jess.
No worries.
Jess is an amazing, compassionate person, by the way.
Has Jess got super helper syndrome?
Ah,
I had to ask the question. You know, it was going to happen, isn't it? Let's be honest. Rod, have you got it? Have you both got it? Talk to me.
I'm a recovering compulsive helper.
Ah, this is very interesting now.
We pull out four beliefs of the book, in the book, and I have held all of them at some point in my life. I will be totally honest. And in fact, there are a couple I still can't let go of quite. So I'm still working on that. But yes, Gavin, absolutely. No, I think we talk a lot in the book about how, or you've already asked the question, you know, how do you become a helper? Is it through, you know, DNA, nature versus nurture? And for me, I grew up with a very demanding mum, single parent, but my role really was to look after her, to serve her, to care for her, to do things for her. So I had from a very young age the belief that I need to be helping in order to be a good person, in order to be a good girl, in order to be loved in return for that. And we talk a lot in detail about other people's experiences of some of that belief as well. That's the they can't survive without me belief. And my mum perpetuated that, like, I can't survive without you, all the way through, you know, until unfortunately she passed away in 2017. But it was my role to help her. You know, I felt like it was my duty to be the person to always jump to her every single need. So, yes, I have had that belief. And I think I've done, but because I've done so much work over the years on that and on myself and on that relationship with her, it almost became more important when these coaching clients over the last 3-4 years kept cropping up and kind of appearing on my list. It almost became more important because I felt I did have a kind of personal raison d'être for the book, you know, or for wanting to help in this way. Because I, you know, when you grow up with somebody who you feel responsible for, and we use examples of the book where interviewees said, you know, I felt responsible for my mum. She was depressed and crying, and I'd never know where she was in the house, but I knew she would be lying down somewhere. And age six, I would be going to the shop, and it would be me, my duty to do the food shopping and to make sure there was dinner on the table. And somebody else said, you know, the cat pooed in my bedroom and I couldn't tell my mom because I knew it would make her really angry. So, you know, a lot of our experience as helpers or compassionate people comes from childhood messages, maybe not so extreme as those examples I've given you. But I think each one of us, and you, Rod, you have experience of the help everyone belief yourself as well.
Yeah, you said whether we're both, have we experienced super helper syndrome? I mean, helping has definitely been a big part of my life. You know, I said that my life has been as a business psychologist, you know, coaching people and running leadership development programs. But I don't think I'm too selfish to have helped the detriment.
At least you're honest, Rod.
Well-being. I have to be honest about that.
Rod, can I explain to you? I don't think you're selfish. I think you're good with boundaries. I think you're very good with boundaries. I think that's another way of it. That's one you can use, Rod. No, but basically, but on a serious level, I think you do help, but you're very good at kind of, right, okay, this is me time. There's things I want to do as well. So, you know, whereas Jess, I can tell she's kind of, I'm going to be really careful now, kind of thing. Self-aware, a lot of self-awareness and that kind of thing. And I think I have traits of super helper syndrome as well, to be honest, just from reflecting about myself when I first heard about the term, when I heard about yourselves. And I think having boundaries is so important, but then the person can feel guilty because they feel that they should be helping. It's a real catch. It's a real difficult. Jess, I can tell you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do.
We talk about helpless guilt again.
We do.
That's right. The guilt is terrible.
How many references there are to guilt? But
guilt came up in almost every conversation with everybody. Yeah. And
I'm not surprised.
Leading with questions.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine.
Not surprised.
There, in the index to the book, the word guilt is indexed 10 times.
And it would be in there more than
some of them are in multiple pages.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right, Gavin, to call that out. Because, I mean, have you ever experienced it where you felt like, oh, I should have helped that person or I could have done
more? I always try. I'm always reflecting about how much more. I mean, I talk to other people about how they manage their caseload and whatever and all the rest of it. And I'm always forever thinking, how much more can I do? You know, and there's so much in the resources that you do have, you know, because you have to be, there's resources, there's other agencies around Age UK and other agencies that we try and use to refer to help people and all the rest of it. But I got to that point where I'm like, I wish I could just go around there and spend time with this person all day, every day to try and help them. But that's not realistic, is it? That's just not realistic.
And that's a sense of taking a responsibility that isn't really yours. And we talk about this in the book, obviously, because, you know, whilst taking responsibility can look like a lot of different things at work, you take responsibility for projects or tasks. You know, there are people, perhaps like us, who will want to take responsibility for other people's feelings and how and their health and their well-being. And it's really difficult when those beliefs are, I must help everybody or I must help in order to be a good person, are wrapped up in our own self-image. If I see myself as a good person, then how can I possibly walk past the woman at the shopping, with her shopping, struggling to get her shopping rather into the back of the car?
Mm.
You know, if I see myself as a good person, surely I should stop, even though I'm going to be late to cook dinner for the family, for the other helping behaviours, et cetera, et cetera.
Rod's going to get hungry.
Yeah, exactly.
He'll call you up. Where's
my dinner? I'm sorry, I'm in the middle of helping. Actually, now I'm driving her. You know, she couldn't, her car wouldn't start. So I'm actually driving her home now with all her shopping in my boot and blah, blah. You could find yourself in, you know, and I'm sure you do, and I'm sure the listeners do, find themselves in lots of different random helping scenarios like that. And you have to think, as some people are really good at, is this my responsibility or not? You know, And at what point do you, we call them helping boundaries, at what point do you make those consciously, the choice to say, actually, I have to choose when I help, who I help, and how I help? Because otherwise, I'm just stretched so far.
There's only one of you. There's only one of you.
And you don't want to be an exhausted helper. If you're exhausted, you
can't help anyone.
To give.
Mm. It's like the first rule of aid, isn't it? Is save yourself first. And then you can save other people.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because obviously, if you can't save yourself, then how can you help anyone else? You know, and at the same time, you need that energy. You need to recharge the energy, you know, that you have. So, and that's where the boundaries become really important, by the sound of things. And that's where the book, I think, will be really useful. It's that kind of book that everyone should have a really real read of. Do you know what I mean? I think it's, as a standard, it should be promoted across government offices and local authorities and councils, because it sounds like it's a very interesting book, and I think it would help, you know, a lot of people. You know, where can people buy it from?
So it's it was published by Flint, who are part of the History Press, and so it's available on all the kind of just about all of the online sites, like obviously Amazon and Waterstones and
W.H. Smith's
Book Depository and all of those places. Is available in bookshops as well. So any of the bookshops either should have it or would be able to order it for you.
We are, because it's a new thing and because thankfully at the moment people seem to be interested in it, we're also we've started a small community, a private Facebook group called the Super Helper Book Club. And we've got, I don't know, maybe up to 50 people in it at the moment, but we're offering opportunity for people to join us on live Q&As, do a little masterclass training. People are already reading through the book and they're asking questions about the themes in the book in there. So we'll keep that open for a few months and just see what happens, really. But we just wanted to make people feel like they have a community of other like-minded people, especially if they are the only one in their family. They're like, who can I speak to about this? You know, so they can talk to us and they can find other people in that group as well.
Sounds brilliant. think it sounds fantastic. If people want to link in with you online, you know, social media, is that okay? Is that a possibility?
Oh, I'd love that. Yeah, my one social media handle is appropriate for everything from LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and others, which is at Jess Baker Psych, Jess Baker PSYCH. And you are at Roderick Vincent.
Roderick Vincent. Yeah, my full name is Roderick. I spent my whole life trying to get people to call me Roderick instead of Rod, and then I put Rod on the front cover of a book. I'm still trying on Twitter to be at Roderick Vincent.
And you're the only one, I think. There are millions of Jess Bakers.
And there's also jessbaker.co.uk/SHS book club, which is where you'll find the book club that Jess was just talking about, where we're trying to provide a community, because we feel really passionate about how this book can help lots of people. Yeah. And, you know, we're really keen for people to hear about it. So we wanted to do that too.
Mm.
Sounds fantastic. Guys, thank you for coming to the show. I think it's been a great show. Really enjoyed having you both. Yeah, honestly.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
Wish you all the best with the book as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for your support and for your enthusiasm. Okay.
That's all right. No worries.
Helping other people.
And thank you to all our listeners for listening. You know where you can find me on Instagram at GavinJ417. Until next time, take care.